Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. This week we reflect on the Lake Wobegon effect. Regional community advocate Bill Mullins talks about this effect where all the women are strong and all the children are above average. The preference to see our kin as above average can subtly create a need to point to the below average. And we're going to talk about education on tonight's forum. This program was recorded on Sunday, April the 5th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will have our usual format. We will have about a 40-minute talk by Mr. Mullins, and then we will have a relatively brief question and answer period. So let's go to the introduction by Craig Volland, and we'll get underway.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the forum committee. This morning we have a very interesting program, Bill Mullins. Bill is a regional community advocate for justice, and I know him to be a deep thinker, and not just because he was once a lieutenant commander on a nuclear submarine, which is actually true. And so I think we have a very interesting presentation ahead of us, and I'll go ahead and, and he's also a member of the forum committee as well. Bill.
Good morning, everyone. Must be able to hear me. Happy Easter. And for those of you of the Hebrew persuasion, happy Passover. I feel fortunate for a lot of reasons to have gotten connected with the forum over the years, recent years, and today I'm going to describe a personal journey around a topic that seems to be pretty current. We've been asked from a number of different ways to talk about race in this country and racism. And for a lot of reasons, over the last couple of years, since I sort of gave up my efforts in the nuclear business, I have been wandering around Kansas City, going to meetings and listening to talks and reading books and meeting with techies and going on startup weekends. And it's really been a rather long 5-year walkabout to try and get a sense of the region and to get a sense of what do we need to do to overcome some of the historic polarities and divisions and stretches and strains that we all know are part of Kansas City and, based on my research, are presently causing us as a region, as an economy, to lose ground against other cities our size and regions our size. And when you know the history of Kansas City and the depth of the strengths and the values that on the positive side of the ledger have made this a great place to be, you start to wonder, well, why are we holding ourselves back from doing something that we've done before? We're not starting from scratch. It's not something we've never done before. But there are things that are holding us back, and I think the legacy of racism, both as a national issue and as a local issue, is a big part of that. I think everybody here knows that race and racism is a hard thing to talk about. If you don't believe that, then stick with me, because I'm going to describe how hard it's been for me to talk about it. And this will be a reflection upon my own journey. And what you're going to see this morning is a seemingly sort of straightforward path from beginning to end, but putting it together was by no means a straightforward path. and I'm going to focus primarily on what's called white privilege. And white privilege is a term that appeared, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, in large part out of the literature of racism, where it came to be understood that there's a way in which white people in this country, the people who are in the majority, are just sort of clueless about the way racism works, or at least clueless about the way it looks to people of color. When we go into a department store, we who look like me, we don't give a second thought as to whether somebody's going to start following us around with a security uniform on. Most people of color, in many situations that we take for granted, experience that. In fact, they're taught to anticipate it as children. They're taught to anticipate that if you're a young person of color, particularly a male, and you have an encounter with police, there are things you don't do. And we've had some very, very, very ugly, unfortunate episodes in this country in the last year or so that demonstrate just how harsh the breakdown of order and justice is around that axis. So what I'm trying to do is figure out for myself, I'm having a conversation with myself about this cluelessness. I grew up in a small town in north of Detroit, about 35,000 people, right on the border with Canada. My grandparents, who came from Canada, my father's parents were second generation immigrants from Ireland. So my people, such as it is, are new to America. And a lot of people who are like me look at the issue of race and sort of think, well, I wasn't part of that. I didn't cause that. I didn't build that. My people never had slaves. And that's all true enough, but it's not on the point. And so I'm going to try to help share at least how I've arrived at what I currently think is the point and how that controls or shapes the way I look at what my role is in dismantling white privilege as a way to moving towards a more equitable society looks like. Most of you are familiar with Garrison Keillor and Lake Wobegon, and of course he is a humorist and he's also an advocate in the social justice sense. So I want to start right off by apologizing. Anything that I say that sounds like I'm making fun of Lake Wobegon and criticizing Garrison Keillor, that's not at all intended. I suspect I don't yet understand all the things that Garrison Keillor tries to teach us. So I am trying to leverage what I do understand so far about all of that. So I've taken the liberty of putting this label above the picture, some ugly news from Lake Wobegon. Lake Wobegon is a storybook place. And when I got to thinking about the history of what I know about racial relations, I realized that one of the earliest influences upon me was a story that came out of World War II. James Michener was an author. He served in the Pacific. He wrote Tales of the South Pacific. And it's a series of short stories having to do with how the life in the Pacific was disrupted by the Second World War. And along the way, he wrote one particular story that became a famous musical called South Pacific. And Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were famous musical theater guys, picked up on this story and realized it was a perfect vehicle for talking about racial privilege and racial conclusions and misunderstandings. And so, whereas in Lake Wobegon, the picture is sort of idyllic, where, as the title says, all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. South Pacific is the tale of a formerly idyllic place disrupted by white Europeans, mostly, in arms with guns and bombs, coming into the Pacific to confront an enemy that looked a great deal different from Europeans. I want to talk about, if woe be gone, where did it go? Well, in the case of South Pacific, as I said, it's really all about racism, but not the truly malicious kind, not the story anyway. The tale, the Michener tale, is more subtle than that. The fighting goes on far away from the centerpiece of the actual play of the theater. It's mostly about a series of white men and women encountering native people in the islands and also some Europeans, some true Europeans, and the discovery In the case of Nellie Forbush, who's one of the central characters, that growing up in Arkansas, there were a lot of things she took for granted, and she never considered until she fell in love with a European man who happened to have a couple of children by a Native woman who had died. And so one of the stories, subplots of the South Pacific, of course, is about Nellie Forbush's struggling with all of these feelings she has that rise up, aversions, in the course of the tale. The truth is, of course, that these feelings still rise up in lots of situations in 2015. So, as I was thinking about this in the context of Lake Wobegon, the obvious conclusion to me, or at least the eventual conclusion, was, well, if woe isn't in Lake Wobegon, then it must be in some place where everything is below average. So I started thinking about, well, just how does this notion of below average figure into the importance of being above average? And might that be a way of understanding how white privilege is coded in our society? This is the left-hand column is a figure that came out of a columnist, Charles Blow of the New York Times. He's a black man. He also is a statistician. He does columns that are based on race, but he also uses statistical information to illuminate. In this particular case, it was about the question of whether or not science is the new segregation. And he included in his column this particular figure, which comes from a National Science Foundation report. And you can't read the details, but basically what it represents is the fraction of working scientists that are in various categories. At the top are white males, at the bottom are black females. In between is a spectrum. So we have whites, Asians, Hispanics, and blacks. He points out in the course of this article that this is not representative of people graduating from college and graduate school with advanced degrees. If you're in the bottom half of categories on this hierarchy, even if you have an advanced degree, you will not get hired in a representative percentage. But science achievement is one way of thinking about hierarchies. And of course, it's authentic because it's science. But there's another way of thinking about the relative opportunity. Every couple of years, the Urban League hires some folks at UMKC who do statistical information to produce a report called The State of Black Kansas City. This is out of the 2010 report, and it happens to show relative unemployment in the four major counties, Jackson, Wyandotte, Johnson, and Clay. The red line is the black unemployment, and the black line is the white unemployment. Interesting contrast there. And this is circa 2009, so sort of right at the beginning of the Great Recession. As I'm thinking about this, I'm realizing from what I know from my walkabout that, hey, economic well-being, poverty, is the real issue here. But I'm going to walk you through how I realize that there are folks who don't want us to focus on poverty. But it's very subtle. Go back to this column. It comes in four parts and it's subdivided between men and women. So, of course, the history of slavery and racism and the history of unequal opportunity for women are two parts of the yet-to-be-completed work of the Declaration of Independence, if we take it literally and sensibly. So just the way this figure is laid out, it suggests that white and brown and yellow, pardon the oversimplification, and black actually represent a spectrum in the scientific sense, discrete lines. When an atomic scientist creates a picture of the elemental content of a particular subject he's looking at. He heats it up and he measures the wavelengths of the light that are given off, and he gets this prismic-like spectrum. And it's discrete. And this is basically the insight to how atomic physics works and how nuclear physics works. And so lots of heavy-duty modern science associated with this notion that discrete spectrums are everywhere in nature. And so what happens in our unconscious and is all of a sudden the science gets filtered through the data, and then we end up with this idea that race is a spectrum. Now, as adults, we're just immersed in this, right? Nobody's being walked through this connection the way I'm walking us through it, or I walk myself through it. But this is the subtext. This is the intellectual context in which white privilege works. And of course, what's wrong with this picture? Well, what's wrong with this picture is we know that if we look at the real economic woe, going back to what's behind that picture of relative unemployment, that hardship is very tangible. And we can see the depth and the span of it. We can read that urban report. We can drive around the Mannheim neighborhood. We know that economic adversity weighs upon health, and we know that it drags upon growth. Craig was just talking to me about having the ability to hire some young men in Wyandotte County to come and help him with clearing on his property, and realizing just how difficult it is for them to have the possibility of going a few blocks to Metropolitan Community College or Kansas City Community College to get an education and then to make a return on it. We hear that story in many different guises from this podium week after week. But woe is countable. But here's the thing. Race doesn't have any weight. It doesn't have any dimensions. Skin shades, they vary continuously, right? The reality is that race isn't countable unless it serves somebody's purpose to make it countable. That's how we end up with that spectrum. Not because those four categories, those four labels, represent anything in nature that is that discreetly different. But we have to have that discrete difference in order to create that hierarchy. That's the perversion. So we come back to South Pacific. In addition to the Nellie Forbush story, there's the Lieutenant Cable story. The guy on the left is the character that Nellie falls in love with. He's a Frenchman. He's been in the South Pacific forever. He's prosperous. He's the sort of epitome of educated European sophistication. Lieutenant Cable is a classic Princeton-type graduate, the cream of the crop in American education circa 1939, 1941. He comes out, he's in the intelligence service. For those of you who don't know the story, he's designated to be a coast watcher. But he comes to this island where he meets, which is a staging point for where the war is happening farther along the Pacific, and he falls in love with a native girl. Crucial point in the midst of South Pacific is a song, "We've Got to Be Carefully Taught." You've got to be carefully taught. And the whole point is that we don't come by these notions of hierarchy and spectrum and difference when we're born. Anybody who's ever watched young black kids and young Hispanic kids and young white kids, young Asian kids in preschool play with each other, there's no evidence that concept of race, as we've talked about in the spectral way, comes naturally. Now, unfortunately, increasingly, it's possible to see some kids who are already starting to be polluted by that idea. But the science is pretty clear. They don't know about this thing, race, until somebody teaches it to them. I want to believe, as a community organizer and a justice person, that it can be untaught. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my thinking about that. So, the trope, the thing that gets implanted by the time kids are 7, 8, 10 years of old and goes on for the rest of our lives if we never examine it, is there is a natural hierarchy called race, and it's just the way things are. It's the starting point. Now, this last part, of course, is what white people think. It's an excuse we use if somebody pushes us a little bit on it. Or we're talking amongst ourselves and maybe somebody had an unpleasant experience, or they observed an unpleasant experience. And, you know, we take the time to wonder out loud, but then we calm ourselves down very quickly. Because it serves our purpose, that we get lots of advantages, that you're able to walk into a store and nobody gives it a second thought. That's a manufactured advantage in American society. It's not a natural one. So it's important that we keep pretending that it is a natural one if we don't want to undergo the discomfort of letting go of some of those advantages. So let's get down and dirty. Where did that all come from? Well, it has a long history. Oppression and hierarchies just seems to be part of the human race. But the kind we have in America, the kind that depends on race and leverages white privilege, comes from Europe. We know that. Folks in this room routinely hear versions of the story about how it's all happened. So when I show you this list of dots that end up getting connected and reinforced, it's not a column, it's not a strict linear sequence. But if you wanted to build a systems map to show how various labels and the terms and the way they're used are connected into a reinforcing fabric that ends up being wealth privilege, the ability of the 1% and above to do whatever they want. Now, my supposition at this point in my journey is that if you have mindless amounts of wealth, you're equally discriminatory towards everybody who's below you in the hierarchy. So there's a way in which the people at the very top, they may act overtly racist, but they don't always. Sometimes they're just plain belligerent to anybody who doesn't defer to this, them being at the top of the hierarchy. And that can be very confusing. You know, people meet with the Koch brothers and they don't seem like overt racists. Well, they're not. They're plutocrats. They're predatory capitalists. So the folks that are at the top, the modern feudal lord, the reign of the castle, is a predatory capitalist. And most of us ordinary capitalists grew up knowing that the guys who made the most money must be the paragons of success in our society. And we have a school system, even though it isn't as segregated as it once was, that tends to reinforce this notion that commercial success is the top of the hierarchy. And for the last 30 years, there's been an active campaign to say success at governing, running government, or being in government is bad, right? Reagan said, government is the enemy. Well, what he really meant was, you poor people, that's anybody who isn't as rich as I am, need to stay in line. You need to follow this hierarchy. You need to accept that. And of course, there's a lot of balm that goes, and that's the white privilege. And so we end up in trouble. So here's my kind of basic conjecture that I've been carrying around and gathering all this information and looking for evidence and trying to put it into this conversation with myself that I'm sharing with you. I think we have a natural need to see our kin as above average. It's that people I know and other. And that's true of mammals. It isn't just humans. But this idea of average and above average and below average, that's a human intellectual concoction. I'm going to go on now into some detail about how this concoction of average is used to reinforce this notion of the hierarchy and, on one hand, keep the people in the middle like us not too willing to go out of our comfort zone. And the people at the bottom, whether they're yellow, white, brown, or black, competing with each other as if they didn't share in common poverty, but rather they're still on a hierarchy. They're just on the bottom rungs of the ladder. These are two reports that came out from Mark in the last year. The one on the left has to do with education and workforce, and it was prepared through a grant from an outfit called the Lumina Foundation, which is a national foundation that's interested particularly in urban education and supporting underserved and under-succeeding school populations. Good guys, as far as I can tell. The report on the right is a pure jobs numbers availability. The significant thing is there is no reference to race in the picture on the right, in the report on the right. And these are about the same length, and obviously you can tell by looking at them that the person who produced them from a Photoshop and display purpose was probably the same, or they work in the same office and they're subject to the same, you know, editorial standards. But when we talk about the availability of jobs and the future and what kind of industries need jobs, race doesn't come up. But when we talk about education performance, race does come up. This is an example of white privilege creeping into a fundamental conversation. Even when we're ostensibly talking about reducing disadvantage, we're doing it in a way that's reinforcing that hierarchy. We have to be able, I have to be able, if I can say that I'm about dismantling white privilege, I have to be able to recognize that. I have to know to look for it. I have to know to be able to talk about it, because I'm sure that what I'm about to point out was not the malicious intent of anybody. It was the subconscious evidence of white privilege. That's my thesis anyway. So I'm just going to focus on the first couple pages of that left-hand report, and I'm going to talk about the design of this report and how it either encourages or discourages you as a potential reader from getting into what the heck's really going on here. So on the very first page, we have sort of three basic zones. We've got a big chunk of text, we've got some bubble charts, and then we've got this thing at the bottom. And I'll come back in detail. But what I'm going to suggest is there's a lot of suggestion, there's a lot of numbers, and there's a lot of suggestion that there are calculations and there are reasoning, there's reasoning going on. But the reality is there's a lot of incongruities. And if we look at it through a racial lens and a poverty lens, we can come to two quite different conclusions about what's really going on here. Again, if we just take the top half of that first page, on one hand, we've got a lot of text. Most of us anymore, because of the internet and television, you know, it takes effort to read text. So typically, this is worthy text, but if you're not really into education per se, the odds are you're going to be skimming this because you don't quite have the time. So you're going to be focusing on the flow of the argument as it goes through the pictures. Okay? These pictures, hopefully you can see that one of the things that's interesting about them is although it talks about early learning and it talks about K through 12 education, it has a lot of numbers that don't make much sense. Like 36,489. Okay, well, if I want to know how many kids, you know, are in the preschool category, about 35,000 is what I need to know. And hopefully the shape and the size of those circles reinforces the point that wants to be made in some kind of proportional way. That doesn't happen here. This is just Photoshop gimmickry. Same thing at the bottom. We do find out that there's 107 school districts in the region, and there's 370,000 kids in public schools, and there's 34 charter schools. But the reality is that isn't all the kids who are in school in Kansas City. And if you don't have a feeling for how many kids are in school that are not in public schools, you're not getting the whole picture. So what you see isn't what you get. And it's going to take some effort to dig below the surface of that. The second half of the picture is the one that really caught my eye when I first read this report. You'll notice the top line, data snapshot, a look at K through 12 students in Kansas City. MSA is the metropolitan statistical area, the MARC domain, nine counties. The very first line on this picture describes the distribution of race of students. It tells us that 66% are white, 15% black, so on. Then it goes on and it says the average income, household income, is almost $68,000. So that's certainly taken us away from poverty, right? And it's sort of reinforcing why the reference to white comes first, maybe. Then we get to the third line, which is to say that 47% qualify, students qualify for free and reduced lunch. Hard to reconcile 68,000 household income with half the kids free and reduced lunch. Now, if you know your way around like we do, that dissonance pops out. But if you're not familiar with some of the background, you just sort of scan through this. And what you come away with is a couple of illusions. One, that first line is important, that it even needs to be in there. Why is it in there? Because all the subsequent statistics are going to demonstrate, and I'll show you, that graduation achievement and testing achievement follows poverty. It doesn't follow race. So this has to be in here for some reason, and the reason is to keep white privilege alive. That's my conclusion. A lot of dissonance continues of this type. On the next page, at the top, we get some reinforcement. It shows us grading achievement. It compares Missouri, Kansas, and the United States, and then conveniently, it breaks it down into black, white, and Hispanic. Now, I don't know about you, but, and then you know, it even gives us a couple of below averages where we're here in Kansas City. I don't know why this picture is particularly useful, except to point out that white kids who go to good schools do better than brown and black kids whose schools are not as effective. I don't want to say bad schools, because that 47% free and reduced lunch has a lot to do with effectiveness of schools. But this picture is the second part of the story, and there's actually four cells, and if you go look at the original report, it talks about fourth grade and eighth grade, math and reading. They all show the same thing. You're lucky if you're born white. That's what it shows. And something about averages, and something about race can be used to compare. Thank you. Now, this is where we get to the take-home message. This is where the contradiction comes out. In this lower left-hand corner, we have graduation rates. Whites, 88%. Good to be born white. Black, 71%. Hispanic, 73%. Poor, 72%. So what does that tell you about how important it is to be black or Hispanic when it comes to graduating? It says the problem is being poor, living in poverty, all the stress and the strain. If you were here last week and you listened to Beth Sarver, my friend, talk about trauma-sensitive schooling and trauma-informed care and the influence of trauma, well, poverty is the most ubiquitous form of trauma that we have in our region. Again, you have to ask yourself, why do they need the circles with the black and the Hispanic? The real take-home message, and this could have been the first picture, was being white, non-poor, makes a 16% difference in your chance of graduating. And of course, graduating is the first important hurdle. The arm-waving part is in the second column, where we get all the way out to four decimal places, or two decimal places, and four significant figures, a picture that basically says average ACT scores are the same around the country. Now, what did I need that for? Because it really distracts from, and what it shows is the person who put this report together was not familiar with the information, and they certainly weren't familiar with making arguments from data. So let's go back to the region and the geography. This is a picture that comes from a map in the MARC map set. What the different colors in this case show are the relative performance of various school districts on educational achievement testing. It very clearly shows that in the center of the region, there are five districts, and that inside that red line has a yellow overlay. There's a darker, lighter color that goes with failure, that pink one. But there are five school districts, Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, Center, Hickman Mills, and Grandview, I believe, that across the board, on average, have less than complete, or less, far less, the bottom end of the spectrum in terms of performance. And they're surrounded, all those dark purple ones are highly successful. Those are your above average school districts. So, of course, that red line coincides with the line having to do with relative economic. There aren't, you know, the average, that $68,000 average of household income does not apply inside that red line, even though we all know there are some real, the top earners live inside that line. Bottom line, educational achievement correlates with income and opportunity, not with race. Two more slides. Summary. What is it that white privilege does? White privilege is a mindset, and it chalks the playing field in Kansas City. That's the best way I know to think about it. I've learned that race is a convenient explanation compared to talking about poverty, because in our founding fathers' days, when our country was created, slavery existed. Slavery needed to be justified. Racism justified slavery. That whole hierarchy I came up with. And there are beneficiaries, and most of them look like most of us in this room. It takes some stress and some strain to get out of our comfort zone and start to notice how our unconscious enjoyment of privilege is actually sustaining what the predatory capitalists want. So it falls on us to deconstruct the Lake Wobegon effect. We can't just hope it'll evaporate. We have to start talking with ourselves, I think, and in the process, then we've got to learn how to talk with each other. And there's so many different ways this shows up that, you know, it's a conversation that's going to go on certainly for the rest of our lives. One idea that I had that I just want to briefly, in thinking about this deconstruction thing, I was casting around for an example where in our society we've done something like this before, and I hit upon the idea of white privilege is like secondhand smoke. We don't smoke. We're not overt racists. And yet, we live in a society that takes for granted that the contamination of the air, much like smoking not so long ago, was just something that we put up with. And then when researchers discovered that, well, no, people who don't smoke can experience respiratory distress and disadvantage as a result of being around smokers, we started to do something about it. And what we realized when we started to do something about it as a society was it wasn't a problem we could fix. We couldn't do away with smoking altogether. And the companies who were in the business of smoking had a lot at stake, so they worked real hard to reinforce that idea. But what we did gradually figure out is we could attack the secondhand smoke problem. We still are with our smoke-free zones and smoke-free restaurants, and slowly we get ordinances. Now, this, as my wife pointed out when I was testing it on her, this isn't a totally apt analogy. But I think it does begin to suggest that we can differentiate between practices that are so overtly subsumed in white privilege, like these reports. We can do a better job on these reports sorting out, making sure that they don't inadvertently reinforce white privilege. Then they become more accurate, and hopefully that helps us to have more reliable conversations going forward. Three recent articles in the New York Times, if you'd like to look them up. Can students have too much technology? That goes to the conditioning that we get into with respect to all this digital stuff, which I've talked about before. Future Segregated in Science is the Charles Blow article, and a recent one that closing the education gap will lift the economy. So people are starting to help get rid of the fog. That's what I have to say. Thank you for letting me bend your ear, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
We're discussing the Lake Wobegon effect as it relates to education tonight on the All Souls Forum. You're listening to Bill Mullins. Let's take a short break. We owe you some things, and we'll be right back with the question and answer portion of our program tonight.
I spent 30 years in New Orleans, and my question is, how many of the lower-income white kids in this area have union cards as far as craft unions? There was a study up in Baltimore or somewhere. Have we done anything like that?
The report I didn't talk about is a very interesting one, and I could give another talk that would sort of go perhaps to your question, because it goes into great detail. In fact, the education report in the back half of it is also has a lot of information about availability of jobs and the connection of education. And what I'd say in response to your question is that it tends to imply that getting a college education is essential, and it's essential because all the good jobs aren't ones that people in unions would be a part of anymore. So that bias that you know, there isn't a range of craft and the different types of knowledge. And that my friend Michelle pointed out that the difference between learning and schooling is that we're learning from the time we're born. Schooling happens in the classroom for the most part, and it doesn't cover everything by a long shot. And we've lost track of that. There's a tremendous pressure from the business community to make education, the education establishment, into a means to produce a workforce that looks like the jobs they want to fill, rather than creating a learned, educated, intelligent society. So there's a lot to be said, and there's a lot of apparent interest on the part of people like the Chamber of Commerce to come up with a diversified workforce. But when you get into the details, these contradictions and the incongruities start to come up. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. I was just wondering, do you think all the prejudices surrounding wealth and poverty might be even worse than racism?
I think that predatory capitalism is the core evil. Yes. If that answers your question, because I think that the reality is that difference, that idea that there has to be a below average to justify me being above average, it just happens to manifest itself in race in the United States for historical purposes. But if you went to India or you went to China, or we look at what's going on in the Middle East between the Shiites and the Sunnis, it's this idea that, well, my people are better than your people, and I'm going to find a way to prove it. Well, that ultimately comes back to the abuse of economic power and wealth, in my view.
Could you say something about one of your topics from the New York Times, having too much, is there too much technology being used to solve problems of education?
Yes. I don't know, maybe a year ago, I got interested in that, part of the way that I try to get at what I think is important about the future of this region, where our kids have a decent chance to achieve, is we have to sort out the role of high tech in relation to the traditional lines of work. Okay, Kansas City historically from its beginnings was a logistics hub. It was a point of departure to the west. It was a gathering and marshaling place, whether it was Lewis and Clark or Jim Bridger or the railroads. So we're very much invested in physical transportation and mobility, what I call mobility one. Digital mobility, this thing that has shown up in the last 10 or 15 years with a never-ending proliferation of devices and gizmos, is what I call mobility two. And right now, the education system is being used, you know, and abused, as far as I'm concerned, with a lot of talk about how if you just buy the right gizmo and the right software, somehow these, it's going to overcome poverty. And that's a pretty nonsensical argument, and I think it leads back to white privilege. And in fact, there's some studies that have been done that show that, you know, two libraries in Philadelphia, one in a wealthy neighborhood, one in a poor neighborhood, exactly the same facilities available to young people. Researchers went in and they watched the engagement of the young people in both libraries, and what they found was in the prosperous neighborhood, there were adults working with the kids. They were being coached and mentored and steered, and in the more impoverished neighborhoods, the adults were off doing something else, and the kids were searching for themselves, and you can imagine where that leads. So this all ties back, and it all starts with, I think, really realizing how easily we get distracted by these grooves that serve other people's interests a great deal more than they serve ours.
Would you comment on the thought, and I think you probably have tangentially, that we talk, the reports we see talk a lot about race because we can't do anything about race. We can do something about poverty.
Well, we can do something about poverty, and we can also do something about race. You know, put it in square quotes and stop using it. It's really that simple. I'm not going to do away with culture, but the history would suggest that race, the term, literally was created by Europeans in North America to justify their supremacy. It has no other legitimate purpose. So we can stop using it. Now, racism is an evil, you know, but it's an evil born of a lie. So we don't have to participate in the lie while we talk about remedying the evil. And the best way to talk about that, I say, is let's focus on the influence of poverty and the difficulty it presents, to tie back to your question. If we focus on making education better for the children who have less economic leverage and resources, we won't have to worry about the color of their skin, and we don't even have to worry about whether, you know, they end up mixed in the proper proportions in schools or whatever.
Before we discard the concept of race, is there anything we can learn about the Asian race or learn from the Asian race?
Well, I think what you can learn is that the Asians, you know, perfected this feudal system 1,000 years before the Europeans did. They didn't use race, but they did use hierarchy. They did use feudalism. They did have lords and servants and mandarins, but different names, same structure. People at the top with most of the resources.
But the second was the eighth was the Brits, Asian.
Right. That's the powerful people's label for those people who live in that part of the world. Okay. They don't call themselves. You know, we live in Asia. They don't acknowledge that our category of race, that spectrum, there's four different races. They don't think that way. That's why we have to stop using it, because it's a totally false construct. Well, it's significant that in the science world, you know, that 12%, they are, if you look at the population distribution and people of Asian origin, they're a smaller fraction than people we identify as black and people we identify as Hispanic. But in science, you know, they do better. And the reason for that's really pretty simple. Their culture's older than ours. And they value education, and they're very diligent, and they value commerce. But we don't need race to explain that graph. We don't need race to improve the fact that if a black person graduates from, you know, MIT with a PhD in nuclear engineering, they should have equal access to a job, just like a white woman who graduates from MIT with a degree in nuclear engineering should have the same access. Jerry.
Thank you for a great presentation, and helps me clear up some of my own perspectives. But it seemed to me that at one point you were talking about poverty being the major issue or the real issue, and I wonder if education, and I've, as you know, I've moved to Kansas City and run for the school board and that kind of thing, because I believe and have believed that education would be the ultimate single word you could put on the solution for how racism could be done away with, along with ignorance and all these other things. So I wondered how you felt about the quality of education that blacks are getting in Kansas City compared to the qualities of education that whites are getting.
I think it's a mixed bag. We know that there are blacks who are getting, who are being well schooled. Again, this notion that just kind of got into my head in the last week or so about learning and education and schooling. Okay, I'm all for improving schooling. And one of the pictures that I want to create here before too long is with respect to this. If I take every building, every school building, and I just look at its achievement, and then I plot all of those on a histogram so that I can see the frequency of high achieving schools, or I could take it down to the classroom level, what I'm going to see is something that looks like this. And again, it's not going to be differentiated by race in any particularly useful way. It will, however, be differentiated by economic availability and access, by the number of adults in the community. When 3.5% of the people in Kansas City public school system electorate show up to vote for the school board, okay, that is a much bigger barrier than the fact that we spend as much or more per kid in Kansas City public schools than we do in Blue Valley or out in one of the outlying districts. So it has to be unpacked. And as it's unpacked, then the role for better schooling is going to end up being about more attention to poverty on the front end and more attention to economic well-being, jobs, on the back end. And schooling is a pipe. But learning goes on besides what goes on in school. And right now, young people on the margin are learning there are no jobs, even as we're asking them to stay in school, because if they get a degree, something good will happen. They know that contradiction, but kids at Shawnee Mission East don't know that contradiction because they don't experience it. If you haven't been by Shawnee Mission East, you should do that someday. Drive down Mission Road and see the parking lot. It's absolutely astounding. As far as I can tell, every kid in that school drives to school. When I was in school, 5 kids had a car.
Compared to the teacher's parking lot.
They all ride the bus. Yes, sir.
I think you need a better education about China and India. In China, there's a place for the various subgroups of Chinese. And if you're in the Han subgroup, you ain't going anyplace. In other words, there's a caste system in China that has just been going on for centuries. The same is true of India. So there's racism in those two societies that have been centuries old, and they still exist today.
I certainly didn't want to create the impression that I was unaware of those hierarchies. Quite the opposite. What I intended to say was, yes, feudalism, which is the process you're describing, okay, I believe, or the term I use,
Feudalism. This is class. You are in a class by a name. It's put on your birth certificate. It's put on your papers and everything else. And if you're in that class, it's one of the ways you get selected or not selected for a job today.
By the economic system. Okay.
Not by an economic system.
This is my journey. Okay. I hear you. I'm not disagreeing at all on the fact.
I had students in Chicago who are from China, they had a better opportunity here in the United States than back in China to advance in certain degrees and professions.
After schooling, right? Yeah. And during schooling. I don't disagree with what you said.
We can carry on this debate in the meeting room in just a few minutes. That was very excellent. Thanks for great questions as well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Bill Mullins, a regional community advocate, reflecting upon the recent MARC education report. Hope you enjoyed this talk this evening. Tune in again next week at 6 p.m. for another All Souls Forum. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 5th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls who provide us the raw materials for this show every week from their Sunday forums. The theme music you are hearing is composed and played by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. You can also access this program via podcast if you missed all of a portion of it or you want to rehear it. Within about a week of the broadcast, it is up on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org. There are a number of past programs from the All Souls Forum already waiting for you to download them or hear them on our website. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.